Good morning. I'm Eric Keener. I'm an actuary with Aon Hewitt, and I'm also a member of the Academy's Forward Thinking Task Force. And I'm going to be moderating our panel discussion this morning on private proposals and plans. So we heard about some public proposals in the panel immediately preceding. Now we'll be talking about some private plan proposals. We'll actually have two specific proposals that we'll be talking about. One is the USA Retirement Funds, and the other is the Secure Choice Pension. And joining me on the panel to talk about these proposals are Michael Krebs and Rocky Joyner. Michael Krebs serves as the Senior Pension and Retirement Counsel for the U.S. Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, where he advises Chairman Tom Harkin on matters related to retirement policy. Michael has primary staff responsibility for pension legislation pending before the committee, including amendments to the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, and he manages the committee's oversight of retirement-related executive agencies. Recently, Michael's been involved in the development of a number of pension-related legislative proposals and acts that were subsequently enacted into law, including the Moving Ahead for Progress in the 21st Century Act, Pension Relief Act of 2010, and the pension investment provisions of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. So Michael will be talking about the USA Retirement Funds. The USA Retirement Funds were initially introduced in a white paper from Senator Tom Harkin, and that white paper was entitled The Retirement Crisis and a Plan to Solve It, and it's actually the subject of proposed legislation that has been introduced by Senator Harkin. Rocky Joyner is a vice president and actuary in Siegel's Atlanta office. He has over 35 years of actuarial consulting experience with various types of pension plans. Mr. Joyner currently serves as the senior actuarial consultant to some of Siegel's largest governmental clients in the Southeast. And he'll be discussing the Secure Choice Pension, which is a plan to create a joint private-public partnership and enterprise aimed at workers that do not currently have access to pension plans. And originally developed by NCPERS together with Siegel, the Secure Choice Pension concepts are currently being considered by a number of different states. With that, by way of introduction, I'll turn the floor over to Michael Krebs to talk about the USA Retirement Funds.
Great. Thank you very much, and thanks everyone for having me today. I'll admit that I am not an actuary, but apparently 80% of you aren't either. Before I get into specifics, I have to give a couple of caveats. Everything I say today should be considered my own opinion, not that necessarily of Senator Harkin or a member of the Senate Help Committee. If folks need, you need quotes from Senator Harkin, you need him to go on the record on something, I'm happy to facilitate that. Just please don't let it be, you know, be me that gets quoted. I would appreciate that. But thank you all for having me again. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and chat. It's great to be in an event that's actually looking big picture, trying to do big things, think big thoughts. The Academy has done wonderful work on the AGES project. I think it's an important topic. Obviously, I care a great deal about retirement security. I know my boss does too. But the fact that there's so many people here this morning that have put so much time and effort into thinking about these issues is really phenomenal. It's a great thing, and I hope you'll continue the good work over the next, over the coming years. So with that out of the way, I'll just run through, kind of lay the put a little foundation out there and explain where Senator Harkin was coming from when he put forward the USA Retirement Funds Act, and then I'll run through the act and kind of how I think it fits into the AGES principles. I started with the committee just about 4 years ago, and when I came on, Senator Harkin said one thing to me. He said, I want to focus on retirement security. I think this is a big issue. And he thought it was a big issue because when he goes back to Iowa and he goes and talks to people on Main Street, they always say the same thing. They say that they're worried, they're concerned, they're scared that they're never going to be able to retire. They don't have retirement savings, or at least not as much as they should. Most of them don't have a traditional pension, and they're profoundly uneasy about their financial future. If you read a recent Gallup poll that just came out, it for people ages 30 to 64, it's their number one financial concern, retirement, not having enough for retirement. And, you know, they're right to be worried. They're right to be worried. The retirement income deficit, meaning the difference between what people have for retirement and what they should have had at this point is about $6.5 trillion, up to $14 trillion, depending on the source, and half of people have less than $10,000 in savings. That's all made worse by the fact that only about half of the workforce even participates in a retirement plan at the workplace. And if you work for a small employer, there's only an 18% chance that you've got a retirement plan. And I'm not even talking a great retirement plan, I'm just talking about any retirement plan at all. That's gonna have very real costs, and I think Senator Harkin recognizes that. It's gonna have costs to the government, it's gonna strain the social safety net, there's no question there. When people retire without adequately funded retirement, they rely on social services more heavily than they otherwise would. But it also strains families, and it strains our own personal economies. I'm sure everyone in this room knows someone who has or will retire and then has to be taken in by other family members and supported by other family members. There's nothing wrong with that, obviously. We all want to take care of our families, but it does put a strain on the younger generation. It forces them to delay their own retirement savings, to delay their own decision, to put off saving for their kids' college education. And it creates an intergenerational tension. So when Senator Harkin started to look at this issue, he wanted to do a thorough investigation, review the system, see what works, what doesn't, and then try and craft a plan that takes what we like and throws out what we don't like and comes up with what we think is an interesting proposal to generate some discussion. So what works? I think we can all admit that having a retirement plan at the workplace or at all is critical to achieving adequate savings rates. People are just much more likely to save if it's at the workplace, and that they're much, much, much more likely to save if they're automatically enrolled in that plan. Using behavioral finance concepts, we've really shown that you can drive much better outcomes by automatically enrolling people, automatically escalating them in their contribution rate. We also need to start providing better results with the limited resources we have. People can only save so much. Wages have been stagnant for three decades, four decades. People are being crunched by rising costs and the stagnant wages. And so we need to make each dollar that they're setting aside for retirement count. That means making the system more efficient and utilizing economies of scale to really drive down costs, as well as driving down costs through longevity risk pooling. So what doesn't work? What did we not like on the current system? Things are overly complex, both for employers and employees, discourage participation. And we've also, my boss has been critical of or skeptical of employers' desire to actually always be the risk bearer in the traditional pension system, but then also to play a meaningful role either as a fiduciary in another capacity in managing retirement plan assets. So the solution to all of this was the culmination of all of this research, and it went on for about 3 years. We did a dozen hearings, half a dozen roundtables in Iowa, hundreds of stakeholder meetings over the years. And what my boss came up with was what he calls the USA Retirement Funds Act, the Universal Secure and Adaptable Retirement Funds Act. It was a proposal which was first put out as a white paper, but it was recently introduced as legislation, which was intended to rebuild the pensions leg of the three-legged stool. So my boss has a Social Security proposal, which is also very critical and expands benefits, but I won't go into here because this is the private sector panel. But Social Security, you expand and improve Social Security, but then we need to ensure that people have that employer-provided pension that provides lifetime income for as long as they live. And then we should also do things to encourage individual savings. And people need a nest egg, and they need to have some cash on hand in case of emergencies. So the USA Retirement Funds Act nothing. There's nothing new under the sun, so nothing in this act is wholly revolutionary. I think what we did was we pick and chose from various proposals that had been around for 20, 30 years, and really try to take the best from them and combine them in a system that we think works. So what the bill does, it says that everyone in the country, every working person, deserves access to a retirement fund. So if you're an employer that does not already provide either a defined benefit plan or a defined contribution plan that looks a little more like a pension, so it has automatic enrollment and lifetime income, if you don't provide either of those types of plans, then you have to provide your employees with access to a USA retirement fund. And I'll get into what that is in just a second. But it's essentially a new requirement that would ensure that every single working person has access to a safe and secure retirement plan. There are a couple exceptions for very, very small employers and very, very new employers, government employees, and religious institutions. But as a general matter, the bill says if you're working for an employer, you're going to be automatically enrolled, either in a plan sponsored by the employer or in a USA retirement fund. Employees are enrolled at 6% of pay. They can go up, down, or out, meaning that they have terminal cancer and it's not time for them to save anymore, then they can opt out. We know, though, that the vast majority of people will stay in the plan. At 6%, some will go higher, some will go lower, but it'll get more people saving. I'll get the taxes out of the way really quickly. It's deductible to the employee up to $10,000. Employer contributions are deductible up to $5,000. So where does the money go here? What are they being automatically enrolled in? Well, they're being enrolled in a USA retirement fund, which, I don't mean to get too wonky, but I'll use the kind of industry terminology here. It's an open multiple employer plan that auto-annuitizes on the tail end. So I'll back that up for 1 second. So a USA retirement fund is essentially a plan that allows many employers to pool their resources and contribute to a single trust, which is governed by a board of fiduciaries. My boss is a big fan of the multi-employer and public system models of governance. He thinks that the multi-employer and public systems have worked very well, having independent boards run their plans, and so he's been a proponent of that and incorporates that into this concept. That board then takes the contributions, manages them as prudent fiduciaries subject to the ERISA standards of care and conflict of interest rules, and manages those assets towards paying out lifetime income. So manages them towards annuitizing at the end, and I mean annuitize not in the product specific sense, but more in the concept. Generating a lifetime stream of income. The plans are fully transparent. There's full fee disclosure. There's conflicts of interest disclosure. There's a whole litany of disclosures that go out to participants to ensure that they understand how the plans are managed and have the opportunity to assess fees and other things like that. And then, like I said, at the tail end of a person's life, their savings, which is built up over the course of a career based on the contributions that they've made, are converted by the fiduciaries of the plan into a lifetime income stream. So now I'd like to just take 1 second and kind of apply the larger principles that the Academy came up with, the AGIS principles, and explain why we think this proposal, the USA Retirement Fund's proposal, really does hit the mark on all four principles. First, alignment. The USA Retirement proposal really tried to align give people the types of responsibility, the different parties to retirement savings, the types of responsibility that they are really capable and willing to accept. So for employers, this plan does not make them fiduciaries. It does not make them manage the money, unless they want to take some role. It does not make them guarantee the funds, but what it does do is rely on the employer to act as a conduit for contributions. That's been pretty successful in both the DC and DC market currently. We think employers are willing to do that, they're interested in doing it, and they currently do it. We also would rely on employers to do what they do now, which is help work with their employees to educate employees to get them contributing at a higher rate or get them enrolled in the fund and explain what it what um, what it means to save for retirement. For employees, they have the choices that they're focused on in this plan are the choices that they're really competent and comfortable making on their own. And that's how much should I contribute? And for very sophisticated people, weighing fees and costs of the various plans. But what we don't ask them to do, and we don't ask the employers to do, is be professional money managers. For that, we've really turned to a board of trustees, which is made up of fiduciaries independent of service providers, who are professionals, competent and capable of managing the funds in a prudent and efficient manner. In that way, we think that each party that's participating in the retirement system really is doing what they're best at. Employers are helping educate employees and ensure that money is getting into the plan. Employees are making the key decisions about how much they can afford to save and how much they think they need in retirement. And then the fund, the management of the assets and the complicated decisions that go into generating lifetime income are being made by a board of trustees of professionals who are ERISA fiduciaries. That gets to the second principle, governance. You know, governance is extraordinarily important to a successful pension plan. We worked for a very long time to talk about the governance structure. If you're not going to make the employer a fiduciary, then you really do need a very firm and solid governance structure in place to manage the funds. We think we've got that. You know, we think we put out a good proposal there. As I mentioned, the trustees have to be independent of the service providers. They're ERISA fiduciaries. They're fully transparent in what they do, including compensation policies. And importantly, and this is something I haven't mentioned to date, the funds would all be licensed by the Department of Labor. So there's a government overlay on top to ensure that the funds are not fly-by-night institutions, that these are reputable institutions that are competent and capable of managing large sums of retirement dollars. Now, on the efficiency front, this was something I mentioned right up front, that efficiency was a goal of my boss. He understands that you can't squeeze too much more money out of participants. There's only so much they can save because of all the things I talked about before. So you really do have to increase the efficiency of the plan. That means allowing small employers to pool their resources to achieve economies of scale, which the USA retirement funds would do. Allow employees to pool their risk. One of the key pieces of the USA Retirement Fund's proposal is it facilitates longevity risk pooling among large groups of employees. And then minimizing leakage. You know, there are a number of sources of leakage in the current system, but one of the ones that's been problematic, I think, from my boss's perspective, is the fact that younger workers get into a plan, they work for a few years, they change employers, it's very hard to move their benefits, so they just take it out. And you know, they do that 2, 3, 4 times over their first few jobs, and by the time they're 40, they've got nothing left. They have not saved for retirement. And so the plan tries to eliminate leakage, or at least minimize it, by not only prohibiting withdrawals, pre-retirement withdrawals from plans, except for very small accounts, but also by encouraging. I think we've got a protest out there. I hope they're not protesting this bill. discouraging leakage by educating employees about the need to keep their money in the plan, and then allowing full portability between funds. So as someone moves between jobs, they can stay in their existing retirement USA retirement fund, or they're permitted to consolidate accounts and move their money from one fund to another. They can even roll money from a DC plan, a 401k, into a USA retirement fund. And then the final point, the final principle is sustainability. And this is another one where we were very focused on achieving not just adequate benefits that are efficient, but also that are sustainable in the long term. I don't mean to get too wonky into the details here, though I know everyone in this room is pretty wonky. But we wanted to find a way to provide lifetime income without making some of the mistakes we've made in the past in other areas from a congressional side. So we allow the funds to do two things, to annuitize in two ways. They can either go out and utilize the insurance system to purchase some guaranteed lifetime income streams, so they can annuitize, or they can purchase longevity insurance from an insurance company and things like that, really tapping into the underlying insurance framework and regulatory framework there. Or the plans can self-annuitize like they would, like a traditional pension would. And in that case, in order to make the benefits sustainable, we use assumptions that are set by an independent board, independent of the funds, you know, some universal assumptions and things like that. But we also allow the funds to adjust benefits to match market realities. So so they are permitted to adjust benefits downward if there's significant market issues. The point of that is to have some flex in the system so that we're not in a situation where we have to pay out very high benefits to current retirees at the that are being subsidized by younger workers at an unreasonable rate. It is a voluntary system, and we were concerned about people pulling, younger workers pulling out and kind of leaving the older folks without support. So we did want to leave some flex in the benefit structure. Now, that has some limits. We do limit, we do say that 5%, if it's more than a 5% reduction, that you need approval from the Department of Labor. That was intended not only to not just to discourage large cuts, but also to ensure that the investment and lifetime income strategy that the plans employ, which is largely set by the fiduciaries, you know, subject to ERISA standards, that strategy, that they take into account the difficulty of trimming, making large cuts to benefits and move towards a more conservative investment and lifetime income path. So that's the kind of broad contours of the plan. Nothing set in stone, obviously. Where the bill was introduced at the end of January, and we have we're accepting comments, suggestions, feedback. I think we want to have that discussion, continue to have that discussion. I'm sure there will be changes to the proposal over time, and we'd love to work with folks on that. So to the extent, and I'll throw this open to anyone here, to the extent any of you, since you're all smart people that do great things and care about these issues, to the extent any of you have comments, concerns, questions, great thoughts, you should really think about reaching out to me directly or shooting me an email, give me a call, something, because I'd like to be able to take the best of, you know, the collective brilliance of this room and really craft a good policy that can pass Congress. So with that, I think I've used up my time, so I'll pass it over to Rocky.
Move over here. Okay. Here we go. Good morning, and it's really, really a pleasure to be here with you. The Secure Choice Plan is something that started back in 2010 with an idea that Hank Kim, who is the executive director of the National Council on Public Sector Employee Retirement Systems, and Hank had the idea that the people around the country were complaining that public sector entities had these great benefits and the private sector had none. So they did some polling. What they discovered was that is not that there was that jealousy, it's just that they needed retirement. They had no retirement and they wanted something. So the idea, Hank said, was, you know, we have systems across the country that are efficiently running retirement systems for a large extent for small employers, particularly the consolidated state systems run programs for small employers all over the state. So the idea was to dovetail that with a plan design that would make sense for small employers in a particular geographic area. These are the AGES principles we talked about all morning, and we think the Secure Choice Plan actually ties into those principles quite well in many ways. I will dovetail with what Michael just said at the end of his talk. Secure Choice was put out there, and we asked people to rip it apart, tear into it, and make suggestions and changes. And across the country, talking with lots of different leaders, we had a lot of good input as to way things could be made stronger and better. And we would request the same thing from this group, because it is a work in process. It is not actually, it is a proposed design. It's not something that's actually been implemented in place anywhere. So keep that in mind when we walk through it. Secure choice, what is it? The plan is to be the third leg of the three-legged stool, which is missing, mainly the pension side of it. We have the 401ks and IRAs that are supposed to be the savings account side of it. We have Social Security, but we don't have that missing three-legged stool, particularly in the private sector. So that was the idea. The other idea was to take advantage of systems that are already in place for investment and administrative purposes. And then the purpose is to just make sure we have lifetime income. We don't want people, that leakage Michael talked about, that's a real problem in the private sector these days. We want to try to do away with that as much as possible. The overriding principles we set up were lifetime security, but those 5 points in the middle, flexibility, portability, predictability, simplicity, and sustainability, that's where we were after. That's the main things we wanted to take advantage of. Now, secure choice, it is a multiple employer arrangement. It is designed essentially to be on a statewide basis, though we have talked to some larger municipalities that might like the idea of structuring a secure choice type program for a smaller than a state area, but if they had a large enough corpus in their particular plan to run a system like this for the employers in their area. We did develop some conservative funding. As you walk through this, you will see that secure choice is designed by actuaries. So be wary of that. By our nature, we can take something simple and make it more complicated. But we do try to work through that. Principles of retirement security. We really think contributions have to be stable. It has to be equitable, committed. Part of the problems in the private sector have been lack of committed funding, particularly. We want to replace income, and you see the other points here on this particular slide. So what is secure choice? This is the baseline original proposal we made. This presumes that we can get changes in congressional approval to do what we want to do on the funding side. It is essentially a cash balance, defined benefit retirement program with a set, what we call allocation rate, which we're going to try to make equal to the contribution rate over the long haul. We have a crediting rate. For the example here, we're using a 5% crediting rate to the accounts, a virtual account for each individual. Immediate vesting, and it is, as the other proposals you heard this morning, is converted to a lifetime annuity at retirement. We've tried to build in things like projected mortality improvements. Here you see the 5% interest rate. We've actually modeled some other things where that 5% floats depending on the interest rates at the time, and added some other features in there for that. The death benefit is the account. That's all there is in the death benefit. If you want to add other features such as long-term disability and additional death benefits, you could do that, but they're add-ons to the program. They're not part of the base program. We worked through some replacement ratios. The idea here is to go back to the three-legged stool. The principle is put out by the 1980 Presidential Commission of savings, retirement for the employer, and Social Security. For a person starting at 25 years of age, we were predicting about 30% for Social Security, a 6% 401k plan over the life of a plan, getting about 25%. And our modeling of secure choice about 29%, giving you about an 84% replacement ratio. Of that 84%, 30% indexed with inflation, the other two not. But you see, it does provide a substantial replacement and adequacy of income. We also had some features in here, I don't have that slide in this particular presentation, where we had some minimum accruals of like a 2 or 3% interest rate, to see just a floor that we don't want to go below, even if the markets are abysmal for a short period of time. Even those would get replacement ratios up into the mid-60s. So we felt like even in a very bad economic period, you could still get something substantial out of this particular plan. The other part of it is funding. We wanted to make sure we don't run into the problem with escalating retirement costs for employers or employees, either one. Secure Source is designed to be either employee or employee contribution driven. The problem, of course, with employee contributions in the private sector is if they go into a DB plan, they're not pre-tax. So that would either take a change or some modification in the way the tax code works, but that's where we're at. We do have a belt and suspenders approach to funding. We don't want to get caught hanging out in the wind if things go poorly. The first layer, of course, is benefit design. Then we've structured layer two and layer three, we turn really actuarial on you quite strongly. So when we get there, watch the math a little bit. And then lastly, if employers terminate, which they do, how is that handled and what happens with it? The benefit design, no prior service credits. Many of the problems with our public sector plans are we gave away a lot of money and then we're funding them over the future. Here, we're starting from the beginning, starting at zero, and moving forward. We want to be very conservative in annuity conversion. We don't want to promise something we can't deliver down the road. And then the other feature in the benefit design, which you'll also see in section three of this, is we want to have the capability to give and share the returns, if they're good, with the participants and the employers in the program. We do that by establishing certain benchmark increases. If the plan gets to certain funded levels, we allow some of that money to be used to improve benefits. If after we've given those improvements and benefits away, the markets correct and go back down, we also have the capability to remove those increased benefits back down to the beginning floor level. Annual contribution. This, we took the main idea for this funding from the multi-employer part of ERISA. Multi-employer plans are pooled in nature, multiple employers all together with one contribution rate, one funding program. So what we did, the standard funding would be the normal cost plus 15-year level dollar closed amortization of all the unfunded that develop over time. Very similar, if you recognize it, to multi-employer funding, funding the gains and losses over a closed 15-year period. However, we have smooth assets in there and we have other things going on. So we wanted to do what we call the conservative funding calculation, which kind of kicks in when markets go south, like in 2008. It would be a normal cost plus a 20-year level dollar amortization of all the unfunded as of the valuation date using market value of assets if the market value were less than the actuarial value. And this we would use a lower interest rate. For the top valuation, we would assume probably an interest rate of about 7%. For the bottom calculation, interest rate of about 5%. The idea of building in conservatism. Then we take 70% of one plus 35% of the other to get a total contribution rate. And it is 70 plus 35 is 105, again, building in a little extra conservatism into the calculation of the required contribution. Retiree dividend fund. We said if the market value exceeds the conservative by 10%, then we start to develop what we call a retiree dividend reserve fund. And the idea being, if we build up assets in the fund in excess of what the base funding is, we should be able to use some of those assets to augment the benefit the participants are getting. The reserve there is available. The other way the reserve can be used, if you have a sustained period of poor investment return or other experience goes against you and the contribution rate has crept up a little bit, you can use this to circle the contribution rate back down. The benefits can, of course, be reduced if in the future the reserve is not supportive of the continued payment of the benefit. Fourth is what happens in termination. This is where we struggle probably more than anything else, is what do you do at the end of the day? Because we want a guaranteed lifetime benefit, but at the same time, a guaranteed lifetime benefit means somebody's got to pay some money. So the question is, who pays the money? And here, because we have structured this to be state-by-state basis, different states may have different ways they want to attack this particular problem. One idea would be to create a withdrawal amount similar to what's done in multi-employer pension plans. If an employer pulls out of the system, you have a calculation of what their withdrawal liability might be and send them a bill for that amount. Secondly, is to establish an insurance pool. The first thought, of course, was use PBGC. That's out there, it's in scope. But we got some pushback from some of the people in different states talking that they'd rather insure that locally. And we actually talked to some of the larger insurance carriers, and there was some interest in that. And the interest was because of the design of the plan, because of the conservative nature of it, the likelihood of having an underfunding when someone split from the plan was small. So we had insurers that were interested in taking that liability on and doing that. Thirdly, if a state, and let's pick on a state just for that matter, if a state were particularly interested in this, because as mentioned earlier today in I think Rob's presentation and in Michael's presentation, as people retire, they generally, 80 to 90% of people retire within the geographic area where they've worked in. They don't move around a lot. If they're not able to retire and remain vibrant people in society, going to the movie, getting their hair cut, spending money, the whole economy of the area hurts. And so the biggest hurt is the state-sponsored low-income support. So if you don't have enough money in your retirement accounts to live, then you're going to come back to the state and say, can I have some more? We need some help here. And that's what's going to happen. So this is the idea of state, if they felt strongly about this, they could develop their own internal reserve to help buttress this piece of it. Then lastly, as in PBGC, if the employer's bankrupt, there is no money, there are no assets, you've got a minimum guarantee, the everything defaults back to what's available in the bank. In the Georgia Municipal Employee Benefit System, which is a multiple employer group of about 300 cities across the state of Georgia, if a city pulls out, then whatever the assets are allocated just like a PBG allocation, so you run out of money, and that's the end of the story. So that would be a horrible situation to get in, and we don't think we're going to get there. You'd have to have a pretty unique set of economic circumstances to get you to that situation. But that has to be the final piece in the mapping of it. Come on. So there are numerous issues that have yet to be resolved because it's not been put into practice. What will be the relationship between the Secure Choice Plan, the sponsor, the employers? Who is the fiduciary? Who takes the role of fiduciary in the whole thing? Currently under ERISA, a plan of this type would have to fall under the single employer funding rules. We actually redesigned the plan to fit the single employer funding rules with other safeguards and features. And that was a very difficult exercise. It did, however, work extremely well. The minimum part of funding the plan worked very well. We were very pleased with that. The problem ran into the maximum deductible limits and the single employer funding, because you could not build up the reserves we need to mitigate the contribution changes under the current workings of the ERISA code. We think you can do that under the multi-employer code, so one of the longer-term things would be to allow these sorts of plans to work under the multi-employer arrangement. We think by using the state plans as a base, startup cost and ongoing administrative would be relatively low. How are contributions going to be made? Employer, employee, combination of both. At this point, we're sort of agnostic on the idea, but it's there and the model is structured for both. We also were concerned with who comes into it. Larger employers, if you've got several hundred thousand of employees, you're big enough to take care of your own problems. However, if you've got 5, 10, 15 employees, you really don't have a mechanism to provide a retirement system for your workers. So this is designed particularly to work toward those with 100 employees or less. And fortunately, in the ERISA code, 100 employees or less, you have some mitigated requirements for accounting and setting things up. We would like, if this comes to pass and a particular state wants to push the details of it, then we would think that moving from the multiple employer model to a multi-employer model would be a very wise decision. It would give you more flexibility in funding. It would help you to handle things like 2008 a lot better than in the single employer model. It would require legislative change both in ERISA and in the Internal Revenue Code for allowing different ways the contributions come into the program. This is a short list of state initiatives. We have a more updated list that we can provide to you, but there are 16 states that have introduced some form of legislation which they're calling secure choice. None of these at this point have introduced the full cash balance defined benefit model, but what they're introducing are things like a pooled IRA account administered by the state plan and with an annuitization, like you described, at retirement of the balance. We have three states that have actually not only introduced, but have been passed and enacted. And it's California, Oregon, and Massachusetts that actually have a program similar where they can take advantage of the weight of the public sector entity in the state to help run a program for the private sector. There are 13 other states that have introduced legislation, and it's at various stages along the way. And there are four more states that are developing some committees to study the idea and go forward with it. So when Hank and Kathy and I started this about 4 years ago, one of the goals was just to raise the level of discussion. As you guys have done, the Academy has done with 2020, as Senator Harkin has done with his concerns, just to bring the discussion up to a higher level, a higher plane, instead of, you know, DB is bad, DC is good, or vice versa. Get rid of that stuff. Find a solution that works, because they're out there. They just take a little bit of work sometimes. We think it stacks up pretty well against the AGIS principles. The alignment, we don't want people without investment capabilities investing money. They buy high and sell low, and it doesn't work very well. That's just the way it does. Governance, we want professionals in here. We want people that are committed to making the thing work for all of our folks. We think the efficiency of the large public sector plans are very strong. You of course, the only headlines in the news are the ones that are doing poorly. Unfortunately, we don't read about South Dakota too much in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. But we need to hear those good stories, because most of the systems out there are run extremely well and are doing really great things in their states for all of the taxpayers or the citizens of the state. Sustainability, we think it works. We think our belt and suspenders approach to funding makes the whole thing sustainable. So we were very pleased with the AGIS principles, and we think with some refinement we can even tie in closer to those principles. Questions? We did some stress testing on this, and you can look at, I think these presentations are available, but the stress testing we did is we modeled it on a perfectly actuarial basis. We get our 7%, everybody dies when they're supposed to, everything worked perfectly, right? And of course it worked. But what happens if the markets don't behave properly? What happens if they go gangbusters? What happens if they go negative like they did during the 2000-2010 period? The way we've modeled this, we think that sustainability piece is still strong and still seems to work. So I'll conclude there, and thank you for let me be here.
To thank both Michael and Rocky for their presentations. We have about 10 minutes for for questions. Before we start the Q&A, though, I just wanted to mention something about lunch. So we're going to be having lunch in a different room. There are going to be four buffet lines. If possible, we'd like everybody to kind of go through and get their lunch as quickly as possible and get seated so that we'll have plenty of time for our guest speaker, Mark Avery. So if everybody could proceed as quickly as possible after we finish up our Q&A. So with that, invite any questions that you may have for Michael and Rocky.
Yeah, Henry Eichelberg with General Dynamics. Mr. Joyner, it's a very interesting proposal. Have you had a chance to socialize it with organized labor?
Yes, sir, we have. The SEIU has actually been very supportive in talking to some of their groups around the country, because the idea being, you know, it's very difficult to organize some of the smaller employers, and you've got that jealousy factor going on. So they think this is really has some merit. They've been very helpful to us.
Hey, Rocky, could you talk a little bit about the relationship between the public sector system in a state and the secure choice idea? Is that something on which you're agnostic as well?
To a large extent, we are, because certain states, you have a large commingled system where they're set up to run this sort of thing. Other states, they're not structured that way. They're structured a little differently. They're split systems, so nobody's that large. In that state, this could work very well with a large insurance company running the program. And it would not necessarily have to be a state system. So we've had those discussions. You have that firewall you've got to put up between state funds and private funds, and you got to make that very strong distinction and be careful with that, but it's there. And we've had that discussion. So the California bill, for instance, sets up a separate board, and the California bill does not demand that the state retirement system run the system, but it allows it. So if the state retirement system is the most efficient way of getting it done, it's encouraged to do so. But if someone in the private sector wanted to run it more efficiently, then the bill would allow that also.
So a question for Michael. Obviously, the Harkin bill has been introduced, but at this point doesn't seem like it's really getting a lot of attention in Congress. Could you talk to some of the political challenges as to why that's not maybe moving as fast as perhaps it could?
Sure. We all know what's going on in Congress, right? It's not exactly the most functional institution at the moment. I mean, we have divided government, and things have ground to a halt, or at least a divided Congress. And we have kind of bounced from crisis to crisis, unfortunately. And so that pulls a lot of the air out of the room when you're We shut down the government for the first time in decades, right? Just recently, and it was very unfortunate. And so, I think because we're so short-term crisis focused, a lot of members haven't been focused on the larger looming crises and the real problems that are facing families. I don't think if you go to Iowa quite a bit. When I go to Iowa, people aren't sympathetic to bickering over ideology. What they want is the Congress to step up and help them figure out how to repair the retirement, how to fix the retirement system, how to improve it. They want Congress solving real challenges. You know, I think Congress goes in cycles. Sometimes it's dysfunctional, sometimes it's functional. At least on the positive side, what we've seen is a sincere focus from a number of members on this issue. On retirement security. So my boss obviously cares deeply about it, but we've seen there are other senators. Senator Brown is a co-sponsor of my boss's bill and has been a real leader on retirement issues, starting to be a real leader. Senator Warren, but on the Republican side too, you don't have to agree with it, but the proposals, I don't necessarily, but people like Senator Hatch, they have proposals out there. They care about retirement security given that level of member interest, I'm confident that maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but at some point in the near future, there'll be a more robust discussion and eventually action.
Question up here in the front.
Yeah, Michael, I was wondering about investment policy or investment approach. There doesn't seem to be anything specific in the proposal. If I gathered right, it was up to the trustees of a particular program to design the investment. So I'm wondering, is that the idea, or is there any thinking? And I'm thinking in particular that particular participants in different situations at different ages would perhaps benefit from different types of investment strategies. And is that all just left to future development or to the trustees, or is there any concepts that you're thinking of behind that?
So it's a really good question, and this is one of the more difficult questions. We, my boss, chose in this bill to say to not mandate certain investment strategies in legislation, but rather to use the fiduciary framework that we've relied on to date in the system to guide investment choices, which allows a lot of flexibility for the plans to custom tailor their investment portfolios and their investment strategies to the participants in the plan. So one thing, the bill does allow portfolio customization for individuals. Not participant direction necessarily, but it does allow some customization for different age cohorts to get at what I think the point you are making. And so we did want to leave a lot of flexibility there to and not be overly intrusive in that process. That said, all of those policies and procedures should be disclosed to participants, and so there's a disclosure regime put in place as well as a fee disclosure regime put in place to ensure that everybody kind of knows the rules of the game going in.
I have a question, Michael. In the USA plan, who is actually going to be administering the plan? Who do you envision? Or is it a state? Is it an insurance company? Is it a local area?
So we don't prohibit anyone from doing that.
Okay.
So anyone can do it. So it's an open structure in the law that any entity that wanted to start one up could. The point there is that, you know, different industries and different states and different organizations may want to do something. Maybe it is an insurance company that wants to do it, but, you know, maybe it's a local business organization, or, you know, a chamber of commerce or a nonprofit or something like that.
Hi, a question for Rocky. I wonder who you see as the target market in terms of employers for Secure Choice, and I guess part of this is, as I'm thinking about this, the employer has to contribute something, right, if I'm understanding that correctly. I mean, given that, is it really about employers who may be sponsoring something and want to step it up to another level? I guess I'm having a hard time seeing employers who don't sponsor anything now jump to this where there may be a significant employer contribution requirement.
The target, if there's a system in place already, this is not, we're not hoping to change that system. We're hoping to augment this, particularly for the small employers who really don't have a way of handling it. The ones that the larger employers, the higher income crowd, the 401k people, the IRA people, they're knocking on their doors, they're there. The lower income, smaller employers around the country that, as Michael said, 50% of them have nothing at all. That's the crowd we're trying to target. So for example, in California, we've actually talked to maybe a distribution system of the local insurance type brokers who would add this as another one of their offerings to get them into the system, to get people into that next level. That's the idea. I agree with you, it's a tough nut to crack because they're not doing anything now. So that's why in California, they took and put the DB side of it to the thing and made it more of a pooled IRA. That's employee money, not employer money. So they have to give access, but nothing more than access from the employer side at this point. So again, it's incremental steps to try to just build up what's missing from a large segment of people in the population.
All right. With that, I think we're at the end of our allotted time. Thank you very much.